You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Ian Graham Leask. Tonight on Right on Radio, Liz Olds talks with Kara Ruder, author of The Next Wife. There's no limit to the lies, suspicion and secrets that can poison the perfect marriage in this twisting novel of suspense. Ruder is an accomplished business leader, entrepreneur, national speaker and international best-selling and award-winning author. She lives in Southern California with her husband, Congressman Harley Ruder, and her four 20-something children.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Ian Graham Leask talks with Lynn Anger, author of American Gospel. Set during a time that resonates with our tension-filled moment, American Gospel cuts close to the battles occurring within ourselves and for the soul of the nation. Anger has published two previous novels, Undiscovered Country and The High Divide. He teaches English at Minnesota State University Moorhead. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Kara, are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Why don't we start? This is Kara Ruder, author of The Next Wife. Why don't we start with just a little bit of an introduction, no spoilers, of course, and then the reading that you have prepared.
Sure. Let's see. I know my books are very hard to talk about without spoiling anything, so I will give you the setup. So before the story starts, we have Kate and John Nelson. They fall in love and they create a business together, and it's flourishing. It's called Eventco, and it's become successful beyond their wildest dreams. They have a daughter, Ashlyn, and everything is perfect until about 4 years ago. John Nelson, and they work in the business together. John Nelson hires a new executive assistant named Tish, and subsequently falls in love with her. And so they are married now. So Tish is the next wife, which is the title of the book. And Tish is about 20 years younger than Kate, and they all work together in the same business still. Mm. And when we meet them, when the story opens, the company is going public. It's having its IPO, and they're all coming together in the conference room to celebrate. So Ashlyn's a summer intern now. She's in college, and this is her summer job. The first wife, Kate, is there, and the next wife, Tish, is there, and of course, John. So that is where we start. So I figured I'd just start out reading the first chapter, part of the first chapter, which is in Tish's perspective, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right. So here it is, chapter one, Tish. Despite popular notions to the contrary, it isn't easy being the next wife. I mean, sure, I have the benefit of his success without struggling through the early days, whatever that means, but I also don't get to enjoy the open spaces of possibility, the opportunity to create a life together, baggage-free. So as we gather in the conference room to celebrate Eventco's big news, baggage invades my space. I note one of the pieces standing just outside the conference room door, Ashlyn, the opinionated and overly dependent 20-year-old daughter. For the most part, we have an amicable relationship, one I've worked hard to cultivate, and she understands the parameters. I used to babysit for her, and we have a certain bond since she told me so many secrets. She thinks I've done likewise. Next to her stands the steamer trunk of baggage, Kate, wife number one. People say I'm a spitting image of Kate when she was young, and I am. We are both slim with shiny brown hair and big smiles. She is simply older by more than 20 years, a worn version of me. In her, I see my future, sort of. She can't seem to stop wearing business suits to the office. I mean, the 1980s are calling and they want their clothes back. Today, for example, she's wearing all white, meaning she's either a suffragette or pure as snow, as if. Despite our differences in age and style, that cliche about men having a type is true. I mean, men aren't that original. They're simple beings, easy to figure out, keep them happy, well-fed in all areas if you get my drift, and voila, a happy life, especially after they've had success. Why would you let them slip through your fingers then? That's when you hold on tight. Sure, they're more work as they get older and more successful, but that's just part of the deal. Some of us know how to keep our men, and some, well, they just don't. I'm going to hang on. There will not be another wife. Kate and I make eye contact, and I grin, reveling in the fact I'm here inside the conference room, seated next to John, while she's milling around outside trying to figure out where to be, where her place is. It's awkward for her, I'm sure. Oh, good. There's Jennifer, our beautiful vice president of marketing, going out of her way to make Kate feel welcome in the conference room. She's gushing over John's past family as if she were a long-lost relative. I should never have allowed her to be hired. Jennifer meets my eye and then quickly finds something to stare at on the floor. I wonder again why I'm forced to work around someone who could be ripped from the pages of a fashion magazine. I'm a fool, that's why. Heaven knows I don't need John's attention divided any more than it already is. I force a smile as Kate and Ashlyn settle into their seats in the conference room, selecting chairs on the opposite end from me at the large glass table. All the officers and key employees fill the room now, the stakeholders, as they call them, numbering 24 of us. Ashlyn stares at me across the table, her entitled confidence misplaced. She has no power here. If she had behaved, been a real friend after John and I married, maybe things would be different for her. But it's too late for that. We act like we have a relationship when John's around, but it's a lie. I break away from the brat and look around the table. Almost all the people here have been here since the beginning. Their tension and excitement are palpable. Beside me, I feel John shift in his seat. He's never quite gotten used to this, all of his family being together in one place, despite the fact we all worked here together in ignorant bliss not so long ago. And I'll stop there.
That's Kara Ruda from The Next Wife. Welcome again to Write on Radio. And you're right. It
Thank
is.
You.
As I was writing questions, I was thinking, how can I ask these questions without spoiling something? So I'm going to be really careful. And you can tell me if I'm getting too close to giving something away. But this is an easy one. What inspired you? Who and what inspired you to write this particular book, The Next Wife?
Well, you know, there's a lot of headlines that you can read about couples running a business and trying to run a family together, too. Bill and Melinda Gates being one of the latest examples. I also had that in my experience. My husband and I started a company together and ran it together for 10 years. And it's stressful. And there's all kinds of things that can happen. We didn't have a tish happen, fortunately, but that's kind of where the notion started. Like, what would happen if you both worked so hard to build a company, to build a family, and then it all falls apart over another woman? So that was kind of the starting idea.
And you talked a little bit about this, but why don't you expand on your experience as an entrepreneur who worked alongside your husband and how did it affect the story? How did it move it forward for you, your own personal experience? And how did that fit in with the fictionalized stuff that you grew out of whole cloth, so to speak?
Right. So we had a business. It's called Real Living Real Estate. We ended up selling it. But we had an office building where he was on one side of the building and I was on the other corner office. So that's very similar to John and Kate's setup when you meet them in the story. And I also found during that experience that, I mean, there's like great highs, but like a lot of stress as well. And the kids would always, we have four kids and we'd come home from the office and we're sitting down to dinner and all invariably business would work its way back in. And the kids are like, stop talking about Real Living. So it's a tough juggling act. And then in this kind of scenario in a business like this, the way to power is oftentimes in between the middle of the two people running the business. So if you can get the ear of the husband, for example, then you can drive a wedge right in there. Mm-hmm. So that kind of tension and stress is really at the heart of it. But I wanted to kind of flip it around too, so that it's not something that's happening to the characters. They're all very active in the plot as it moves forward.
Yeah, you know, you in terms of form, you chose to write the story from several different first-person views. Tish and Kate and John and Ashlyn, each first person. I'm wondering, boy, that seems like an awful lot of balls to keep juggling in the air. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could talk some about that juggling and also how you managed to keep it all rolling.
Yeah, thanks for the question. The last two domestic suspense novels that I wrote were all first-person point of view, but with a single narrator all the way through. So Best Day Ever has a male narrator point of view, which I'd never done, all the way through a full book named Paul. And then in The Favorite Daughter, Jane has a similar tale that she tells in first person. So it was actually a little bit freeing to have more than one point of view on page. Mm-hmm. So while this book jumped into my head and it started with Tish, as the book starts out with Tish, as soon as she began to tell her side of the story, this character, Kate's like, wait a minute. I have something to say about that. So then Kate kind of unfolded. I'm a pantser, so that is really how all of my books have become so far. And once Kate started speaking about her side of the story, then the daughter, Ashlyn's like, wait, I've been watching everything. I have a point of view too. So I know that sounds weird when the characters kind of start speaking to you, but that's how it happens for me.
No, I enjoyed it. It was, I kept thinking, okay, what's going to come next? Who's gonna speak up now and have their say? What do you enjoy about writing? So would you call this suspense? It's not a mystery, I don't think, but it could be suspense or it could be a thriller. I'm wondering how you define those things as an author for yourself, and then I'm wondering what you like about writing these books.
Yeah, I would call it the genre that I kind of am drawn to. I believe most people call it domestic suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that means it's something with a family and there's drama within the family. And there's also something people behaving badly in the suburbs is what I like to write about. I'm a product of the suburbs. And it's like always been like what happens beneath the surface of seemingly perfect lives. And the whole notion of keeping up with the Joneses and the grass is always greener, all of those kind of cliches all come from that, right? So we spent most of my kids' time growing up in Columbus, Ohio, and that's where the story, The Next Wife, is set. And then we've been out here in California almost 15 years now. So it's funny because you can write about the suburban experience and be talking to a group, a library group in Dallas, and they have the similar experiences in the suburbs there as they do in Ohio, as they do in California. So it's a very common kind of way of looking at things and way of looking at life. And I think that's why these books resonate as well.
So that you would say would be the reason that readers find these books so appealing.
I think so. I mean, I think it's always nice to escape into a story that takes you away and maybe amplify some things that you see in your own experience in the suburbs. But then you're like, oh, my goodness, I'm so glad it didn't go there. Because
yeah.
These books are meant to what I write, I want to be entertaining. I want you to maybe chuckle a little bit with dark humor. And it's definitely an escape. It's not anything, you know, literary, but I do think that they serve a purpose and they're fun. I love reading domestic suspense and I love writing them too.
Well, it's kind of the bigger they are, the harder they fall too with your corporations and going public and
yeah.
People being very, very, very rich and suddenly
yes.
It doesn't matter anymore. Things happen.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about you as a writer. You have been very successful entrepreneur with the real estate company and working with your husband and so on. But it sounds like from the information that I read on the publication that it was kind of a dream of yours to be a writer all along. And I'm wondering how you moved forward with that. And what would you say to people who are dreaming of that while they're doing something else?
Yeah, and that's the key, right? Because with the writing life, I think a lot of people start it as their side dream, and that's perfectly fine. That's how it was for me since third grade. I knew that I wanted to write novels or be a writer. I don't know if I articulated it as novels, but I had a very clear passion for that. But I also knew that I, you know, needed to hone my chops and also make money. So I was a journalist and a magazine editor and then turned to marketing and then eventually ran the company with my husband. But all along, I was always writing on the side, either for freelancing for magazines or doing my own projects and just kind of working on my craft. So that was always kind of the passion on the side, but I knew I wanted to do it full time. But you know, you write your first draft and maybe put it away in the drawer and bring it back out again. So when I was running the business with my company, with my husband, the American Marketing Association asked me to write a manual for marketing. So I was going around the country talking to women entrepreneurs, and I decided to turn that instead into a pitch for a nonfiction book. And the entire point of Real You Incorporated, 8 Essentials for Women Entrepreneurs, is telling people that you can live the life of your dreams, put your passions into action, even if it's a side hustle to start. Just get started. And that's what I did myself. So I was going around the country telling women just that, like thousands of women in these big halls, because once you write a nonfiction book, they expect you to go talk about it. I'm like, I put everything I know in the book. They're like, no, go talk about it. So I found myself saying those words to people and realizing I hadn't fully committed to the dream yet. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I sat down and I pulled out the draft of my novel I'd been working on and made it my full-time job for, I guess, about 6 months and then submitted. So that's when I first made it real, I guess. But all along, I knew what the dream was, and I knew that maybe I'm raising 4 kids and I'm working full-time. Maybe now isn't the time that I can be a full-time author, but I'm going to be doing it in my spare time. So I'd write at night when the kids went to sleep. I'd write anytime I could.
We're speaking with Kyra Ruda, author of The Next Wife. And we're talking about dreams, making dreams come true. You, in addition, obviously we've talked about this a little bit already, that in addition to an author, you have also been a very successful business person. And one of the things it seems that is important to you is giving back to your community. And I'm wondering if you would want to talk a little bit about some of the things. One of the things that really interested me was the homeless work that you did in Ohio. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that and also about some of the other projects and giving back kinds of things that you try to do.
Sure. I mean, as you know, and most people know, once you start being involved in charities and giving back, you get so much more in return. So I smile when I think about all the things because I just have such fond memories every step of the way. But the shelter for homeless families you're talking about was back when I was in my 20s. I was working at an ad agency, and I read an article about homeless families. I hadn't until then realized what happened was the moms and the little kids were separated and put in a women's shelter, and the husbands and older boys, like boys over 16, had to go to a men's shelter. So there you have this family. The last thing they have is being an intact family unit, and they were getting separated. So I got a group of volunteers, and we got together and created a campaign and actually started the first walk-in emergency shelter for homeless families in Columbus, Ohio. So it was a really rewarding thing to be involved in. And like I said, it was all volunteers and all young people. And we just knew that that wasn't the right thing to have happening. And we got corporate sponsors, and it was amazing. The people I met along the way, we would have a big holiday party every year for all the kids at all the shelters, and, you know, wrap presents and have them all. It was a amazing experience for myself and hopefully for those that were helped by that. But I do think that if you can, and if you have the time, giving back. I've been a big fan of food banking and making sure food insecurity and shining a light on that. So that's also one of my passions, I would say, is to, because with food banking, a lot of times they're getting not used food into the hands of people who really need it. And in a country like ours, it's so sad to say how many people are going without food, especially children. So that's another area I like to be involved with.
Mm-hmm. You did some work in Ohio, some giving back work, and the book is set in Granville, and that's in Ohio, right? A kind of a fictional story. What about Ohio is it that you wanted to set this story there rather than California or New York or someplace else? And why Granville instead of just calling it Columbus for all day's sake?
I know. Well, okay, so Columbus is a city, and Granville is a made-up suburb, which is, in fact, Upper Arlington, Ohio, where all my kids were born and where we lived, where my husband was born, as a matter of fact. So we lived there for many years. I'm a proud graduate of Upper Arlington High School, so I like to know my settings really well so I can let my people kind of run free there. So it's been funny. Best day ever. My first domestic suspense was set in Columbus this suburb of Granville. And then the favorite daughter hopped over to Southern California, and it's really the character they'll come with like a setting in mind and their, I don't know, their character presence. So Jane was definitely wanting to be in Southern California. And then when the next wife popped in, Tish was, I'm in Ohio and we're going to be working in this office in downtown Columbus. So yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, but for me, like I said, the suburban setting is really key and the similarities between suburban settings, even though people wouldn't necessarily think that Ohio and California have that much in common, they really do when it gets right down to what people care about and what they're trying to do to raise their children and make a happy life. So that is why somebody's home, which comes out in January, is set back out here in California.
Ah, so you've got a book coming out. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure, sure. Well, I can't, it's so funny. I haven't like got it in my head yet to talk about yet, but it is, it's another domestic suspense and it's the story of two families, one home and too many secrets is the kind of tagline. And it's kind of a notion of belonging. A mom and a daughter are moving out of the house that they've always lived in and getting away from her husband into this home that the wife and the other husband have to leave. See, I don't really have it clear yet, but it's all centered around one home and kind of who really belongs there. So hopefully I can say it better than this by the time it's ready to come out, but I really like it.
How do you
too.
Come up with these incredible plot twists? I mean, they're zinging, zagging all over the place. Fascinating, fun plot twists.
It is really fun. And that's, I mean, like I said, I mean, I've wanted to do this as a living for my whole entire life. So it's such a blessing to me. And the creation, the coming up with the plot and kind of sitting down for the first time with a blank computer screen and having stories come to life. I mean, there's nothing better that I can think of. So to me, it's I have plenty of stories. It's just getting them down on paper and hopefully having my agents like them.
Well, it sounds like you have got a lot going on here, putting out this book and finishing up the next one. So we will keep an eye out. Be sure to get me a copy of the next one, and we will read that and talk about it. We've been talking with Kyra Ruda. The Next Wife is the name of the book. It's a domestic suspense. It's very, very fun read, very quick and fun read, and if you love suspense. So I want to thank you for being with us on Write on Radio tonight.
Thank you for having me, Liz. Thank you for reading it, and I will get you a copy of Somebody's Home.
Yes, I would love to. Okay, I'm going to let you go, and we will move on to our calendar. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, how are you doing, Ian?
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So this is Ian Graham Leask here talking with Lynn Enger about his newest book. It's not absolutely new. It came out in 2020, American Gospel. And he's going to read, as usual, a part from this somewhere. Have you got a section selected that you like to read?
Yeah, I was thinking, how long would you like me to read?
Oh, just a couple of minutes.
Okay. Yeah, there's about a two-page section here I could read. It starts on page 19.
Okay, I'll follow along.
Okay, it's a conversation between the two of the main characters. The old man Enoch, who's in his 70s and is calling his son from his hospital bed. He's recently had a cardiac event, and he's telling his son, you know, about this prophecy that kind of is at the heart of this story.
Yeah, we'll get into a synopsis when you're done reading here.
Yeah, so I'll just read this section. It starts up bottom of page 19. He sits up in bed now, open to the drawer of the nightstand, and fumbles for his pocket watch, whose glow-in-the-dark hands show 12:37. He lifts the bedside phone, sets it on his chest, and dials his own number. Let him answer, he prays, which Peter does on the fourth ring, his voice sounding high and full of something like relief or maybe hope. Hello? Peter, it's Dad. Ah, disappointment. Who'd you think it was? Is everything all right? Peter asks. I dropped a bomb earlier and thought I should explain things better. Peter is silent for a moment, then says, do you want some advice, Dad? That stuff about August 19th, it makes you sound like a fucking lunatic. Best not to talk about it. Enoch winces. You should hear the whole thing before you write me off. Peter moans, a resigned moan, but it's an opening nonetheless, and Enoch doesn't let it pass. He describes walking out on the porch with his coffee yesterday, new sun lighting up the chrome steel cross at the top of his barn and touching the tall obelisk of black granite in the Lutheran cemetery to the west past his neighbor's hog farm. He recounts to Peter the smell of bacon frying, Victor's monotone voice coming to him through the screen a couple of minutes, and how he stepped down into the yard to check on the struggling buckeye tree. That's when he felt a vague tickle in his throat, but no pain whatsoever as his heart spiked to 400 beats a minute, its lower chambers reduced to an ineffectual quiver, this according to the doctor. First the ground beneath him disappeared, then the buckeye tree, and finally the sky itself, a dark wash rising up on all sides and lifting him, astounded, to a promontory high over the sea. What sea it was he didn't know, but the sun was a blood orange hanging above it. Then a voice from behind caused him to turn, and he saw a woman, tall as a spruce and wearing a gown of water, her hair a blue flame. Watch, she said, and count the days. Which Enoch did, turning in time to see the sun fall like an egg from a table down into the sea and blacking out the world. One, Enoch thought. But it was already roaring up behind him, a bright, booming spotlight, and climbing to its zenith before dropping and disappearing again. Two, then it was back once more, rising and falling, which it did again and again and again, until a storm arrived, a wind so terrible the earth pitched like a great mad bull. Enoch could feel beneath him the land itself being urged across a wide vastness, until finally he was back at his own place. In all of this, Peter, while I was lying on the ground, more or less dead, you say she had blue hair, this angel? His son doesn't even try to hide the scorn in his voice. Maybe it was your mom, grandma. Remember the dye she used to use, the way it glowed in the sun? And she always had to think about the end of the world. This was not your grandmother, Peter. Make fun all you like. But you heard what the doctor said, and I know what I saw. 14 sunsets, 14 days. Not 15, not 13. Let me finish, please. The sound I heard then, coming from an opening in the clouds, it was as if all humanity were present, exercising their lungs. I was standing in the pasture behind the house, next to the rock pile, with you beside me, and others too, a whole crowd of us, looking up at the roiling sky, the noise above us rising to a great shout. Today is the sixth, Dad. 6 + 14 makes 20, not 19. Didn't you say August 19? Yes, because tonight would have been the first sunset. Not to mention the 19th of August has always been a significant date for me. It was your mother's and my anniversary, of course, but this isn't about me. Look what's happening in the world. The Middle East, my heavens, Armageddon just around the corner. And here at home, what they're doing to Nixon. Look what he's done to us. Enoch tells himself to remain calm. I will only remind you, there is no power but of God. And the powers that be are ordained of God. That's St. Paul from the book of Romans. The president was placed where he is, and we ought to be praying for him, not working against him. Bullshit, Dad. You'd rather be deceived than have to think for yourself. I'll stop there.
Really good. You've been listening to Lynn Enger reading from his latest book, The American Gospel. He's published two previous novels, Undiscovered Country and The High Divide, which was a finalist for awards from the Midwest Booksellers Association, the Society of Midland Authors, and Reading the West, His story has been published in literary journals such as Glimmer Train, Ascent, and American Fiction. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and has received a James Michener Award, a Minnesota State Arts Board Fellowship, and a Jerome Travel Grant, and teaches English at the University of Minnesota in Moorhead. And once again, welcome back to Ride on Radio, Lynn Enger. So very brave of you to write an actual, the actual event of a vision, which you put right into that very well chosen section. It reminded me a bit of Joseph Smith and that whole story about the visions he sees. Where did you derive all this?
Well, it's a long story. I wrote a book 35 years ago. The first time I tried to write a novel, and it was these characters, the old man, were at the center of the book. But it was a rambling kind of angst-driven story about fathers and sons. The old man was a religious zealot, and the young man was rebelling against him. But there was no real plot to hold it together. I exercised probably some demons of my own, and I wrote it, and I realized when I was done that, you know, it wasn't much of a novel. I put it away, and I came back to it a few years ago with this idea that it could be animated and made to, you know, function as a novel with this notion of the man's prediction of the rapture that is imminent. And so that's how, you know, there's a long backstory to this, to how this novel, you know, came to light ultimately.
Well, I've got some other questions and then we'll probably circle back to that. So you've got the backdrop here of Nixon's resignation. The story's taking place in 1974. I guess all of us of a certain age remember where we were when that happened, right?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yeah, I was hitchhiking around America. I was just a British kid with a pair of cut-off shorts going around America and was in a diner when it happened. And, oh, my, the place exploded with fireworks. It was really, really interesting. So I did find it very interesting the way you juxtaposed this resignation with the threat in the early part of the book of an Armageddon or the end of things. And you draw an interesting distinction in here between the end times and an Armageddon. Can you break that down for us? What exactly is that between the rapture and the final return? Can you that's a fairly large part of the book. Can you get us to understand that a little bit better?
You know, in heartland evangelical circles, there's an obsession with what is called the rapture.
Yeah.
The rapture is it's doctrine. And it's a relatively new doctrine. You know, it didn't really show up in the Christian church until probably the 1800s as a popular doctrine. And the notion is that before things really fall apart and Christ comes back to you know, eradicate the world and start a new one. In the eschatology of that, there's this moment before that tribulation period where Christ comes down and he plucks up the faithful so that they don't have to experience all of the horrors that the end will bring. And so Enoch, who has been schooled in that kind of eschatological thinking, you know, he believes that this dream he has, it is a prophecy, the dream that I just read. And the odd thing is that I grew up in middle America, coming of age in the 70s, during a time when meaning people who went to evangelical churches, were being schooled in the idea that the end was imminent. I can't tell you the number of sermons I listened to where we were told, you know, maybe 5 more years, maybe 10 more years. You know, as a kid, I took that to heart. And I felt very resentful about it, because absolutely. I thought, hey, I'm just starting out. I want to have a life.
Naturally.
I don't want to get raptured. And so the funny thing is that this just keeps coming round and around. It doesn't ever go away. And about the time that I was deciding that I could use that premise for this forgotten novel I'd written, I went to the spring graduation at Minnesota State, where I teach in Moorhead. This was early May of 2011. Mm-hmm. And as I walked across the street to the building, Alex Nemzik Hall, there was a big bus parked there. And there was signage on the bus that said, "Prepare yourselves. The end is coming on May 21st, 2011.
Yeah.
And this was there were buses sent all across the country by a man named Harold Camping, who had a Christian radio station in California. And he was also into numerology. And he believed that the May 21st, 2011 was going to be the date of the rapture. And it was broadcast pretty well. People sold their homes. They gave him their money, and people all across the country. And of course, I was quite taken up with it, because, you know, I knew this scam inside and out. I grew up with it. And so at the time that I saw this, I thought, oh, I think I know what I can do with this story. I will allow my zealot protagonist to have a vision of the rapture. And there'll be plenty of pilgrims and seekers who show up at Last Day's Ranch, which they do in this novel. So that's kind of the, you know, the germ for me.
So of course you were triggering for me the whole Branch Davidian thing with David Koresh, and further back, closer to the time of this story, you had the whole Jonestown thing, and they brought it all back to me. And you handle the character of Enoch very kindly. He's a sympathetic character and extraordinarily intelligent, and is able to garner a terrific rapport, you know, with the people that follow him. It's a small group, but they're also fairly intellectually engaged with what he was doing, which I assume is something that happens, and sort of anthropologically, I think for some reason this seems to happen, and did happen with Jonestown and David Koresh and the rest of it, didn't it? So you're definitely following a pattern here, but you don't get revenge on him. You treat him as an equal in this story. I really like that. That made sense to me.
I'm glad you did. When I was writing the book, of course, I was thinking Jonestown and Ruby Ridge and all of these stories of communes, of one religious communes, where the leader of the commune it seems like they have to take them out in a violent purge. Usually, I mean that's the story often. And I didn't want to follow that pattern. I've known a lot of Enochs, and they tend to be kind people, sympathetic people, and smart people. They might have a serious problem with grandiosity, and they're certainly misled. They certainly have a deep need to live a profoundly meaningful life and to give meaning to others, like Enoch does. But I didn't want him to be a monster because in my experience, people like him aren't monsters. It was relatively easy for me to write him because I had I had living or recently deceased people in my mind as I wrote. I was kind of tangentially involved with a couple of groups like this in the 70s and groups like in Minnesota. And they tend to end in two ways. They either end because of money problems, or they end because of some kind of sexual trend. That's the way those things end. In my, you know, at least as I've observed. So I did try to find a way out for him that was a little more exciting.
Well, in some ways, that's what I often draw as a useful distinction for our listeners, many of whom are writers themselves, between literature and popular fiction. Is in popular fiction, one would tend to create a rather flat character here and have him be a lunatic and, observably so. That's changing a little bit. There's a little bit more sophistication starting to creep in the last couple of decades. But yeah, this is a real person. And the unshakable faith that you're writing about here, which I, like you, have witnessed in various areas all my life, you know, and in London there was people walking around on every corner of these placards, "The end is nigh." Everywhere. And I remember talking to one once and saying, "Well, what happens when it doesn't take place, which is extremely likely? Do you agree?" And he said, "Yes, I agree. It's unlikely that I'm right," which made me laugh. And he was very articulate and very well spoken. And I said, "Well, how do you deal with that?" And he said, "Well, God will know that I had faith.
Right.
God will know I had faith." So it was still worth it, and it was still something that made sense to him. And it struck me then as a kind of mental illness. Do you think that's possible? This kind of mental illness.
I think in the case of Enoch, I have tried to explain it to myself, and it wouldn't. It seems to me that he probably has it, and I can't diagnose it. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I think he does have a mental illness. There's also this profound need for control and meaning, you know, transcendent meaning, but also control. I mean, what? Imagine if you believe that you know that the date when God is going to appear in this world and effect this profound change, that's a remarkable sense of control that it gives. And I think people who buy into conspiracy theory they're around us all the time. I mean, right now we're living in a time that is just rife with conspiracy theories. I think it gives people, one, a sense of control and a sense of being on the inside and understanding what other people don't. I think there has to be a kind of benefit psychologically, emotionally, that these people are getting. That's what I'm writing about. And, of course, ultimately, it's about deception.
So when you chose to pull this book out, pull it out of the drawer and finish it, which is, I think, is often a very wise thing to do. Is Horace said, you know, put your book away for 10 years, you know, and you kind of did that. And you pulled it out. There must have been some impetus for writing it, given what is happening to us right now with the extraordinary rise in fake news and the belief in fake news.
When I actually finished this version of the book in 2017. So it was about a year into the Trump White House. And the book, I wasn't really thinking about current events when I wrote this draft in 2015 through 17. If I had written it, say in 2019, 2020, I think it would have been a far more political book than it is.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So Yeah, but when it came out last fall, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and we're in the middle of a absolute craziness in the election, and fake news, and you know, the whole cult of personality. We're still trying to find our way through. It did feel timely then to me. I don't know if it did to most people who read it, but certainly it did.
It did suffer the book's distribution and sales suffered, of course, through the because of the COVID situation.
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't do in the past. I've you know done book tours and you know it was I did some Zoom events, but it wasn't a good year for releasing.
No, I talked to my friends down there at the University of Minnesota Press, and a lot of very, very depressed publishers. It's a marvelous book. I mean, I'm really sorry that it didn't have as much impact as it could. You know, perhaps they could re-release it or something like that. But let's talk just a little bit about the character of Peter. I've got a few minutes left here. And you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you were, you know, working on some, perhaps some stuff out of your life and your relationship with your father, which I think is what we talked about last time with the other book. Tell us a little bit about that in relation to this fanatic father, Peter's character.
Well, I think if there's an alter ego of mine in the novel, it's probably Peter. He's a writer. He has a very powerful, in this case, father who he has to bury, really, if he's going to come into his own. I wouldn't say in that way my experience was similar. My father wasn't a religious zealot. But there were enough forces in my life that were Enoch-like that I can identify with. Peter character.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, he's a writer. I don't know how other people do it, but for me, when I write fiction, it's only years later that I'm able to really understand very well in what ways my books are autobiographical. I feel like I always come around to seeing how they are, but while I'm writing, I don't think about that. I'm not consciously mining my experience, except in more generic ways.
That's a really good that's a good answer to that. So here's the conclusive question that we always ask, you know, what's next? What are you going to do next?
Well, I right now I'm not writing a book. I'm kind of in between. The pandemic year for me wasn't a creative year at all. I know people for whom it wasn't. More power to them. It wasn't for me. So I'm hoping that as we come out of this funk, national funk we've been in, I hope I'm able to find my way into a good project. But right now I'm not writing anything.
All right. Well, that's a shame. And I'm here to ask you, and I know I do it on behalf of all the staff here and all our listeners, to write another one soon, because we love your work and we want to have you back on the show again as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for this wonderful book, American Gospel, a novel by Lynn Enger. Well done, my friend. Thanks. See you again next time.
Okay.
Bye. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. I'd like to thank our guests today, Kara Ruda and Lynn Enger, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, you can listen to recent episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts can be found.